just wanted to thank everyone for coming and thank Rob for organizing and Space and Culture Crew. So, like I said, my presentation today is sort of it's a work in progress. I'm actually working on a chapter for a special issue right now for, it's on the theme of saturation and the theme of sort of environmental saturation on some level. That's supposed to be published with Duke University Press sometime, probably early 2018. And it stems from a workshop I participated in at that was organized by UC Santa Barbara, the English department there. And so I thought I would kind of start by giving some background to where it all kind of comes from. And then I thought we could use like the discussion period to sort of talk about where this might go, I guess. So basically, I'm a longtime researcher of libraries from a communication studies perspective. I've looked at libraries from all angles, historical, architectural, spatial, technological, educational. And throughout this research, I've actually discovered that there is a lot of overlap between libraries and the natural environment, mostly when it comes to their architectural form. And so in my more recent research, what I've kind of sought to do is to extend my analysis from libraries to a related set of institutions and settings that consider other spaces of classification and conservation, particularly, as you'll see, those that serve to archive the natural environment. And my aim has been to take objects of study as objects of study institutions with different kinds of collections whose mandates and values, some of which sort of are consistent with the mandates and values of libraries. So these institutions have sort of faced the same pressures that libraries have faced and continue to face in remaining publicly relevant. And many have resorted to some of the same solutions, technological, architectural, corporate, in order to challenge some of these pressures. So these are the kinds of places that I'm looking at. So,
can I ask a real quick question?
Yeah.
Just about a library, is a library is an archive of storage, or is it a place of retrieval? Just need to get the definition right.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both, right? Okay. And I'm kind of looking at it more in kind of a broader sense. So I'm not saying these institutions do exactly what libraries do.
Right.
I'm just saying that there are kind of some kind of protocols that are consistent with those that libraries have been kind of using and following for the past decade or so, maybe more now, I guess. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So what I explored in my previous work were the sort of emerging media ecologies that characterize contemporary libraries. And now what I want to do is explore whether and how these same ecologies have migrated from knowledge institutions oriented to archiving the circulation of culture and cultural memory, so both of what you just said, and to those oriented towards the archiving and circulation of nature and natural memory. So is there, in some sense, a library ecology that pertains across public knowledge institutions that have not previously been conceived of as libraries? So institutions such as this one, which I have here, the Library of Water, houses three distinct but related collections of glacier water, an ice-related word repository, and a large collection of weather reports. Svalbard, I'm sure everybody's heard of, preserves duplicate samples of a wide variety of plant seeds, and the National Aquarium in Baltimore, which I'm primarily interested in, is currently seeking to become a full-fledged conservation organization. These three sort of examples are diverse examples of attempts to collect, preserve, and archive nature. And there are actually many more examples, and that's the New York Times article that I had circulated if you had time to read it. There are so many more examples of these types of repositories that exist right now, such as the coral. That was a mistake, but anyway, the Coral Restoration Foundation in the Florida Keys, for instance, We've got the National Lab for Genetic Resources Preservations in Fort Collins, Colorado, the Exotic Animal Milk Bank, which I found fascinating, the U of A's own ice repository, which I actually didn't get an image of. We're very secretive there. We still have to go for a tour.
You can't get in.
Well, we think we can get in.
There's a tunnel from Earth and Atmospheric Sciences that you can sneak in through.
Okay. But these kinds of projects are actually also happening on a smaller scale. So this might be interesting for... Sorry, I forgot your name.
Michael,
this is actually a seed library. It's called the Next Epic Seed Library. And I found out about it through a conference that I went to last May in New York City on libraries and the Anthropocene. And it's actually just a couple of librarians and archivists that started collecting the seeds of plants that are growing in urban, kind of wastelands. So you'll have, you know, like a bunch of concrete buildings, and then in the middle you'll just have like nothing. And there are all these like trees or whatever, grass that grows. And it's really interesting because they're actually different. It's not just grass, it's like grass that can grow, you know, through concrete and stuff like that. So they collect these seeds and they kind of look at how these different species have mutated in order to survive in these kinds of urban strange environments. So that I thought that was really interesting. So we kind of see this trend to try to, like, you know, conserve and contain everything that is not conservable or not containable or will eventually disappear. So this is kind of what I'm interested in. And the reason that I'm putting more emphasis on institutions such as the Library of Water, Svalbard, and, you know, the Baltimore Aquarium is more on more than some of these other repositories is more kind of because of their unique relationship to architectural process and design. Hi. So in each of these cases, the concern to preserve, store, and provide access to fragile and vulnerable natural phenomena has prompted institutional architectural media strategies that exceed the traditional models of natural history museums and public aquaria, for instance. So the aim here is to really explore and analyze those strategies and to ask whether, in light of the path-breaking reconfiguration of libraries as knowledge and cultural institutions in recent years, we can detect a sort of library ecology extending across these otherwise distinct domains. So to bring this back to this kind of theme or problem of saturation that I've been thinking about for this paper, I mean, I guess we normally think of the idea of saturation as a problem. I guess you don't have to think of it as a problem, but libraries, it could be said, have been dealing with the problem, per se, of saturation, so information and, like, physical overload of books and stuff, since their early existence. Or maybe we can say, rather, that saturation is the condition under which libraries have been formed, or one of the conditions under which they have been formed. And John Durham Peters, in The Marvelous Clouds, writes that history variously organized documents past time is an apparently unique anthropological condition. Other animals carry their species history in their genes and have individual and even collective memories. We carry our deep history in DNA as well, but we also carry it in external storage media. Our nature interacts with our history. Externalization means both power and fragility. The leverage we have seen with ships, fire, and agriculture, sky media, and writing. The human investment in external storage media creates problems such as information overload and artificial intelligence. The bank of knowledge in a literate society always exceeds what any individual can know. The classical name for this condition is library, and the more recent name is internet, he argues. So the transformation we've seen, or I've seen, if you're not interested in libraries, maybe you haven't noticed, in the architectural design of libraries from Halifax's newly inaugurated Central Library to the Chicago Public Library, their Chinatown branch, to the spectacular, I hope that one day I can go and see this library, the Yun Library in China. These were all sort of libraries that were built primarily to deal with space constraints, or saturation, if you will, to either build facilities that could hold more books or to eliminate them altogether in order to put a whole bunch of other stuff in them, like computers, and actually more recently just people. Or in the case of the Liyun Library, to put nothing in it at all but wood. In fact, in the case of the Liyun Library, everything about the project, from its program and position to the materials and distribution circuit, is geared to creating a place of contemplative tranquility in deliberate defiance of the hectic pace of modern-day China. So in other words, the Liyun Library was built to escape saturation. And I think, at least for someone who's been studying libraries for a really long time, I think we're kind of beyond discussing the role of books in the library and whether or not the book in print form will disappear or not, and so forth. So I don't really want to dwell on it here. Libraries might be saturated with books, but that's not the only thing that saturates them. The library's role to serve as a holding facility of memory and knowledge has in recent years expanded. And so while the term library to designate the cultural institution we as scholars do our research in has over the years been modified to learning center, tech center, community garage, makerspace, and so on. So the designation of library has actually been kind of moved and has made its way to other institutions, such as the Library of Water, as I was showing you before. So I would say that the designation library has itself been saturated, and the idea of what a library is or should be has also been saturated. So what is a library today anyway? It's kind of everything. It's something to every person. So is it a tech center? Is it a learning center? Is it trying to be all things to all people? Probably. And the other idea is that if we are moving into an era where nature now, or our natural environment, is being classified and preserved, are we in, you know, have we transitioned into a moment where we have equally become saturated by our natural environment? Which actually seems completely paradoxical, because as we've seen with the Liyun Library and many other libraries have followed suit here, we normally turn to our natural environment in order to escape saturation, so much so that newly designed libraries are literally making themselves look like forests, which this is a really good example of. So I want to I'll leave that up there. Bring us back to the theme and title of my presentation and what I mean by it, so conserving the future of precipitate ecologies and architectures. There are many ways in which we can define saturation. We can consider it a state of overabundance, a state of being overly full, a condition of being thoroughly soaked, a situation in which we are simply overloaded with information, and more. Some of the questions I would like to focus on in the time I have left is what is produced, designed, created as a result of saturation? Or in other words, what precipitates out of conditions of saturation? How do we think about libraries, for instance, as architectures built around particular environmental media instances? What happens to institutional process and architecture when the environmental media form it is supposed to contain is constantly in flux? And what I want to do is put two ongoing projects in dialogue with each other as examples of architectures built around particular environmental media instances, ones that I will argue stem directly from the hazards of saturation, with both resulting from various varying forms of cognitive saturation surrounding responses to the relationships between time, materiality, and practices of environmental protection. The first project I want to focus on is this one. I don't know if anybody's heard of it. It's called Future Library. It's an art project that's being put forth by Katie Patterson, who is a Berlin-based, pretty sure she's Scottish. I'm not sure. I don't know why I don't have that information. Anyways, she lives in Berlin, and she's quite a well-known artist. She also, if you're interested in ice, she actually has an art project where she's actually recorded the sound of a melting glacier. And she had you, like, you could dial a number on your phone and listen to it, and listen to this, like, glacier melting, basically. So this is her sort of ongoing project. And what it is it's a project that's intended to span over 100 years. So I'm going to look at this one first, and then I'm going to look at the National Aquarium in Baltimore, which is currently in the process of designing a new building that will signal a change in its mission to go from being an aquarium that incorporated conservation to being a full-fledged conservation organization that also runs an aquarium. So this growing unease about information overload, I would say, so Future Library kind of fits into that aspect, and about cetaceans and other species in captivity, which is where the National Aquarium will come in, echoes our increasing unrest and mounting need to reintroduce nature back into our urbanized, industrialized, and technologized lives. By focusing on these two cases, my presentation today seeks to explore the increasingly complex relationships between conservation and preservation, media technologies, architectural design, and the reconceptualization of the environment, and how these issues are all bound up with states of saturation that inevitably and materially precipitate novel art organization and architectural responses. Okay. She is Scottish. I do have that written down.
She's Scottish.
Yes. So, in 2014, Berlin-based Scottish visual artist Kitty Patterson, in collaboration with Bjørgaga Utvilling and the City of Oslo, began an art project called Future Library. This is an art project that is intended to span over 100 years. A forest with 1,000 trees has been planted in Nordmarka, Norway, in order to supply the paper to print an anthology of books that will be read in 100 years' time. Between now and then, one writer every year will contribute a text with the writings held in trust, unpublished until 2114. Tending the forest and ensuring its preservation for the 100-year duration of the artwork finds a conceptual counterpart in the invitation extended to each writer to conceive and produce a work in the hopes of finding a receptive reader in an unknown future. And so Margaret Atwood is actually the inaugural writer for the project, and she's already submitted her manuscript entitled Scribbler's Moon. So none of us here will ever read Scribbler's Moon unless we extend our lifespans, I guess. In 2015, David Mitchell took on the charge of being Future Library's second writer and handed in his manuscript in the spring of 2016. And this year it was an Icelandic poet and lyricist named Estrón, I think. And he's been named third writer to contribute to Future Library. And he just handed in his manuscript in June. So the goal is to have the manuscripts displayed, only revealing the author's names and titles of the works in the new Deichmanske Public Library in Bjørvika, which is supposed to be opened in 2019, and that's pretty much what it's going to look like. And the room they will be displayed in will be designed by Katie Patterson and will be lined with wood from the Nordmarka Forest. Now, this is conundrum to me because, and I wanted a personal interview with Katie Patterson, but apparently she's about to give birth or something like that. Yes.
Wow. Perfect.
Perfect.
Great excuse.
I know. She sent me a sort of like a write-up of an interview she had done. But the one question that I wanted to ask her was why she cut down trees in the Nordmarka Forest in order to build up, like to plant these new seedling trees for this project. And I just thought environmentally that was confusing to me. I mean, I don't know, maybe the trees were dying or maybe they needed to cut them down, but it was just interesting to me that they kind of destroyed a forest in order to rebuild a new forest. And so the trees that they cut down will actually line the room of this of this silent room where she's going to put these manuscripts to be read in 100 years' time. Did you have a question, Alberto?
No, I was just surprised to know she was here in 2013.
At the University of Alberta?
Yeah, and the university acquired some of her works, and she did a publication called The Piano.
Called what?
It's called The Piano.
Oh.
With Art Gallery of Alberta.
Oh, very interesting.
So,
we'll look into that.
Interesting kind of.
Yeah.
It's the natural cycle of forests also to destroy itself. So, like, I mean, it's the forest burning is done.
Well, that's what I'm wondering, if it was part of some sort of cycle that she kind of recognized and felt it was okay. But, yeah.
It's a different kind of ethical thing to see just something as being destroyed. With the nature has a different kind of ethical cycle.
No, that's very true, and I thought about that for sure. I just wanted to hear it from her, but maybe I will still. Anyways, so although not initially conceived of as such by the artist herself, Future Library is an example of a kind of generative infrastructure in the making. While it is a critical reflection and commentary on our old infrastructures of knowledge, will the book and paper format still exist in 100 years' time? If it does, will there be anyone around to read it? Or will there be anyone who can read it? The project also poignantly highlights the relational qualities of infrastructures of knowledge. It emphasizes not only the obvious complicated transfer of knowledge and ideas within a span of 100 years' time, one that has been carefully chosen by the work of human infrastructure, but it also underscores the complexities of having a fledgling forest growing within our contemporary infrastructural frameworks. So in other words, the forest existence is subject to whatever happens to our environment over the span of the next 100 years. Whatever political or economic decisions are made, whatever natural disasters it might be subject to will have a bearing on whether and how our present ideas are circulated in the future, at least in this particular example. That's the wood that was cut down from the from the Nordmarka Forest. So not only does Katie Patterson's art/library project illuminate the interconnectedness of nature and history, the seemingly new trend of merging nature, the forest, and wood with the institution of the library, but it also underscores a temptation we have to possibly manage saturation. In other words, Future Library as a generative infrastructure in the making, as a work of human infrastructure, could also be seen or understood as a way of guiding or controlling what gets transferred, but not only what, but how much. And I just wanted to share a little excerpt from the interview that I got from Katie Patterson about her project. And she writes herself, Future Library is not a directly environmental statement, but it involves ecology, the interconnectedness of things, those living now and still to come. It questions the present tendency to think in short bursts of time, making decisions only for us living now. It's an artwork made not only for us now, but for a future generation, in an unknown time and place. In its essence, Future Library is hopeful. It believes there will be a forest, a book, and a reader in 100 years. The choices of this generation will shape the centuries to come, perhaps in an unprecedented way. Inside the forest, time stands still. This place could have existed for 100, 1,000, 1 million, or even 100 million years. I take comfort in the natural processes that have unfolded over such enormous expanses of time. And I just have a few more things that she says. The timescale is 100 years, not vast in cosmic terms. However, in many ways, the human timescale of 100 years is more comforting. It is beyond many of our current lifespans, but close enough to come face to face with it, to comprehend and relativize. Arv Rod, in his essay about Future Library, said, I don't know if the purpose of Future Library is to incite concrete action, but the project is at least meant to create and support an attitude. Future Library is not a campaign to make a political point, but an invitation to feel the proximity of nature, to care for the forest, and to be aware of life as it evolves, to see the relationship between the natural environment and man-made cityscapes and architecture, and to show confidence that those who will come after us will see the worth in continuing the project's practical work and artistic content. Future library is not about completion. For me, the most important element of future library is already finished, in the form of a promise that in 100 years' time, a new spring will come. Whether it will remain is up to us. Okay, so that's future library. So I want to contrast future library. I know it's really strange with Baltimore Aquarium, but I'll try to bring it all together at the end. So the National Aquarium in Baltimore is I would say an exemplary case of a library ecology in the making, as it's an institution that is in the process of remaking itself from an aquarium into a conservation institution that draws on many of the media protocols that libraries have developed and deployed over the past decade or so. Originally designed by architect Peter Chermayeff, the National Aquarium, which opened in 1981, was intended to serve as an aquarium as theater. Over the past 30 years, visitors to the aquarium have been encouraged to navigate the space as though they were being directed in a film, with alternate lighting and various ascending and descending pathways creating a dramatic effect. As it stands now, the National Aquarium in Baltimore, as many aquaria to date, has served to offer audiences a glimpse of aquatic life, but one that serves to entertain rather than to attempt to offer a genuinely mimetic representation of sea life. In fact, although located on Baltimore's inner harbor, the aquarium has almost no connection to the harbor itself. Its concrete structure turned away rather than towards the harbor. Furthermore, since its opening, few visitors are aware of the fact that many of the aquarium's dolphins held in captivity, the institution's main attraction, have died due to the poor conditions in which they were kept. Since his arrival at the aquarium as chief executive, John Racanelli has made the public claim that he wants the aquarium's dolphins to be moved off-site and live in a sanctuary. In 2013, the National Aquarium approached Chicago-based architect Gene Gang to design a new building that would signal a change in its mission to go from being an aquarium that incorporated conservation to being a full-fledged conservation organization that also runs an aquarium. The National Aquarium's mission is to try to retrain audiences not to expect a show from dolphins, but to observe them in their natural state. And it is hopeful that through Gang's redesign of the aquarium space, it will succeed in reconceptualizing a new kind of space for dolphins to thrive in. Moving the National Aquarium's dolphins into a sanctuary would mean losing one of the institution's most attractive features that draws in the majority of its visitors. To counter this, Gang envisions the possibilities of erecting screens in the aquarium that would track the locations and movements of these new semi-wild dolphins off the coast of Maryland. In addition to approaching Gang in a consultative capacity for the infrastructural and architectural redevelopment of the institution, the National Aquarium has extended its mission even further by launching Blueprint, an ambitious strategic public consultation process. Launched in September 2013, the Blueprint process focuses on four key areas of research and inquiry, which the National Aquarium hopes will provide a healthier future for the aquarium and its animals. Blueprint's key areas of focus are fourfold: the future of aquariums worldwide, reimagining the National Aquarium experience, designing a new role in the nation's capital, and the future of dolphins at the National Aquarium. The aquarium has anchored the Blueprint process in innovative methods of public consultation and feedback gathering in order to build transparency into the mission goals of its reconceptualization. So far, this is the National Aquarium Strategic Master Plan, and I just got this off of Gene Gang's architectural website. So far, what they're looking at doing, and I'll just read what's up there. At the urban scale, the plan suggests connecting the aquarium's current facilities, separated by the former ship slip in Baltimore's inner harbor, with an urban wetland. By providing outdoor educational and social spaces for visitors and the public, the plan simultaneously improves the local ecology, creates a campus identity, strengthens connectivity, and extends the aquarium's growing conservation work in the region. Inside the building complex, the plan calls for a redesigned circulation sequence to enhance visitor flow through the exhibits and visitor amenities. The plan also creates and enriches spaces for education through a new unifying concept for the exhibits on both piers, while Pier 3 would offer an expansive tour of global hope spots, treasured places on the planet that are worth protecting. Pier 4 would become the domain of the region's spectacular natural asset, the Chesapeake Bay watershed. Coordinating the architectural experience with the exhibits and education spaces, the design takes visitors on a journey through the various ecological zones of the Chesapeake watershed, the United States' largest estuary and among the most fragile. Educational labs and classrooms are integrated within both interior and exterior exhibits and reveal back-of-house functions like the fish kitchen. New program areas become intimately tied to the aquarium's conservation work. So the National Aquarium's proposal is an expression of the increasingly prevalent trend towards the extension of the boundaries of not only what we understand to be a media environment, but also what we consider the environment as such. It begs the question as to who should be at the forefront of the decision-making processes involved in the redesign of such institutions. Architects, scientists, politicians, activists, the public. It equally poses the crucial question as to whether the reproduction of the environment through the deployment of media technologies and architectural design is indeed a way of preserving it. And so I think this is what they kind of wanted to look like at the end. So as a sort of conclusion, one of the issues I'm dealing with now is of how kind of to tie these two cases together. Well, I've tied them together in my head, but I don't know if that makes sense. So the basic question that at the heart of this chapter that I'm working on is, what is produced, designed, created as a result of saturation? Or in other words, what precipitates out of conditions of saturation, and how does it alter our evolving relationships with impulses to conserve the natural environment? And I'm leaning towards the following approach, but I'm open to sort of discussing what directions I might take in this. So in both Katie Patterson's work and the Baltimore Aquarium, there's a return back to the environment proper. So literally, a return to the soil, to trees, to that which produces paper. And in this case of the aquarium, a return to the ocean, to water, to that which has the potential to saturate, literally. And the only issue or difference is that it's never a true return, as it's been altered by human intervention, by the work of human infrastructure, by technology. As such, the precipitate here might be defined as that which seeks to mimic or conserve or preserve nature, but with the help or via anthropogenic technical capacity. In this view, and thinking about the concept of precipitate ecologies and architectures in a broader sense, I think they signal a response to the time scales that our environments make palpable. Forests and oceans, after all, are markers of planetary time. So thinking about the unstable kind of precipitates that our anthropogenic planet is producing today, Patterson and the Baltimore Aquarium are offering kind of coping strategies to navigate a nature we can't really go back to. And a whole bunch of other examples, like all those repositories that we've seen. So that's